Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. As some of you know, I spent a while as a stalwart contributor to the Village Voice in New York City. Late 1980s to the mid-1990s was my heyday, and it was a wonderful time to be in New York, to be writing for an alt weekly, to be writing for the Village Voice. It was a great time. In some ways, the 90s were the last great time for that that paper, though, you know, it continued on well into today. And there were a lot of great writers and great editors at the Village Voice from whom I learned an enormous amount. And some of the writers that were also my friends and intellectual interlocutors included folks like Julian DeBell, Lisa Kennedy, and of course great rock writers like Robert Christgau and Chuck Eddy. But my favorite writer at the Village Voice was Greg Tate. And Greg Tate wrote for The Voice for about 20 years, starting in the mid-80s, writing about mostly black music, hip-hop, art, but also politics, science fiction, technology, just an, you know, omnivorous mind, you know, well beyond, he spills far beyond the already capacious boundaries of one of the leading critics of African-American culture. I'm very psyched that he has just putting out a new collection of his essays, Flyboy 2, The Greg Tate Reader, following on his an earlier collection, Flyboy in the Buttermilk. And it's so just been just a complete gas for me to read these essays, because in a lot of ways I stopped reading a lot of cultural criticism, at least a lot of the stuff that I find online, because I think it most of it sucks and it's sort of depressing. And so to be reminded of what in my own life was the experience of immersion in really rich writing that was simultaneously informed by scholarly questions and studies, by politics, by a knowledge of history, cultural and political and technological, and most importantly, in some ways, a stylistic affirmation of the verve of the non-academic, whatever you want to call it, street, slang, goofiness, you know, hermetic languages, esoterica, the sort of richness in prose that can bring all these things together into an amazing alchemy. And because I love Greg's prose so much, I'm just going to read a chunk before we start chatting. This is from an essay, a remarkable essay, one of a number of remarkable essays about absolutely central black musicians in American history. And this is on Charles Edward Anderson Berry and the history of our future. And of course, we're talking about Chuck Berry here. And I'm going to read two paragraphs here. Every spanking new musical twist needs an avatar to hang, plant, and pluck its ripest fruit upon, its own Johnny Appleseed. The music we call rock and roll was bequeathed Mr. Johnny B. Goode himself, Chuck Berry. Berry is the iconic template and the role model of every cocky, geeky, and charming guy with a radical guitar style we've seen since Who Roams the Land, reeling and rocking to the beat of his own boogie while confessing to immense sexual frustration and extreme land speed velocity. The bell-ringing guitar intro to Johnny B. Goode is as heraldic, annunciatory, and emancipatory an invitation in American music as those new beginnings heard on Louis Armstrong's Weatherbird, John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, The Rolling Stones' Satisfaction, and Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child. All of which let other musicians know that there was a new sheriff in town. All are musical exemplars of what us folk here in critical theory land like to call an epistemic break. Hell, an epistemic breakdown, really. Some hella crunk nouveau knowledge that interrupts, disrupts, and transforms our sense of life's possibilities and the kind of folk we believe to be forces for apocalyptic change in the world, too. So that writing just kind of captures just a lot of what I love about Greg. Super insightful, capacious in his allusions and sense of history, an amazing mixture of highbrow and street or whatever you want to call it, and all mixed up in a kind of prophetic intensity that's also funny, charming, and vulnerable in a really amazing way that keeps what would otherwise be aggressively overintelligent mind from running us over. So anyway, I've blown enough smoke in the room and the virtual room, Greg. But anyway, I really just want to say thank you for the hard work of all you've been putting in for so long, and for this new collection.
Hey man, glad to be here.
Well, let's talk a little
Rap.
bit about the voice. Like, what was it about the voice, writing for the voice, the opportunities, the audience, the editors, the politics? What was it about that kept you sort of in that orbit so long and so productively?
Well, I was a voice fan from Washington, D.C., where I was not birthed, but definitely reared and raised. I was born in Dayton, Ohio, home of the Ohio Players, sure. But when, I became like a serious follower, devotee, fanboy of free jazz, freedom jazz, freedom swing jazz, particularly all the post Coltrane stuff was coming from Cecil Taylor and Art Ensemble Chicago and Henry Threadgill and David Murray and Butch Morris, all these people who hit the scene in New York in the mid-70s and were coming from hither and yon. And Stanley Crouch had started writing for the paper about those very musicians, like in the late 70s. And I'd actually started reading Crouch when he was at a black pinup magazine called Player in the 70s, and then followed him to The Voice. And so for those of us in DC that were eager to know what our these young jazz hellions were doing in New York, you had to read The Voice, and you read Stanley and you read Gary Giddens, and there were Peter Watrous, but they were kind of like your ear to the street, and also they kind of let you know when we made these pilgrimages up I-95 to just go hear some jazz in New York. They let you know what was happening and who was happening that week. So all of that's like, I'm still at Howard University, mid to late 70s. Of course, once you pick up the paper, you start reading the other stuff in there. So you're reading Lester Bangs, you're reading Chris Gow, you're reading Jay Hoberman on film and Russ Weston on theater. You're just becoming like a little cosmopolitan sponge from afar, in terms of New York culture. And my good friend, Talani Davis, became a copy editor at The Voice. She had been working in, she had been teaching private school down in DC. And then she left to come back to New York because she spent a number of years. She went to Barnard, in the late 60s, early 70s, and got a job in the copy department. And she started writing for the paper. And I remember seeing a piece she wrote on James Brown. And she wrote a couple other pieces. And she told me, you should send Chris Gow some of your stuff, and I think it took me about a year before I worked up the courage or the nerve or the moxie to send him something, and it was actually a thing I wrote like on the train coming back home from a Nona Hendrix show at the 930 Club, which was kind of our CBGBs in DC. And I just said, wrote that thing, typed it up, sent it to him. Say, whatever happens, happens. And I remember he called me and he just said, I can't publish this, but the more writing I get like this in the paper, the better I like it. I was like, well, that's encouraging. And so I sent him, so we didn't, I think the first assignment was a piece on a Pharoah Saunders album, fairly kind of tame, and he actually pointed out that compared to my sample, it was a little lukewarm. So I revved it up for the next piece, which was a review of James Blood Homer. And to leap forward again, like that piece actually was responsible for me getting my first jobby job in New York, because there was a gallerist, Linda Good Bryant, about a year later after that. You know, that piece was published, I think August 81 is actually, you know, when I wrote like my first couple of pieces for Bob. And about a year later, Linda Good Bryant, Jam Gallery, Tribeca, first black woman to have a, you know, probably the only black woman in the history of New York, actually, as it turns out, had a kind of minimalist, conceptualist, abstractionist oriented black, you know, mostly black exhibiting art gallery in, you know, Tribeca in the 80s. And she was doing a festival she called Afropop, needed a music curator. And Quincy Troop, who a lot of people know for doing the Miles autobiography, or, you know, co-writing with Miles, he suggested me on the basis of reading that Blood Homer piece, you know. So that actually became the first of those hyperlink kind of random situations that occur on the regular in New York once you get in the loop. And Linda brought me to New York to work on this project, and you know, I made the move, made the jump, and did the usual couches, floors, gallery, stone, you know, basement, you know.
Yeah, it's a rich ride. You know, there's a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of traditions and a lot of lineages you tip your hat to in your book. But for me, I think I got the most, or learned the most, or sort of felt the most about that free jazz zone. And it's kind of a funny thing now, because from our perspective, it can look at once kind of radical and kind of not dated, but just so much of its time that it's hard to see beyond it. I mean, at least for most listeners. And it took me a while to be able to find my own way into it, although I was nibbling at the edges of it when I was in New York. But yeah. What is it about it?
Well, the thing in particular about, you know, like the guys that came through in the mid-70s were coming from Chicago. They were coming from the Midwest. They were coming from California. They were coming from New Haven. And the thing was that, like, kind of free jazz 1.0, you know, came out of, you know, the work Sun Ra and Ornette Coleman and Albert Eiler and John Coltrane in particular were doing, like, kind of that inspiration. And that was a whole community of cats who were down in the Lower East Side in the 60s. And Amiri Baraka wrote wonderfully lyrically about them in his book Black Music, which really made me, you know, want to kind of delve in. I was reading that book that really kind of turned the corner for me more than anything else, you know, because as a friend of mine said, he wrote about those things, those guys, so evocatively that when you put on the music, you felt you already knew what they sounded like, you know. So, but the guys that came through in the 70s, you know, had that, kind of had a cerebral distance, you know, from the Sturm und Drang, you know, and, you know, the kind of balls to the wall, screaming it out approach of a lot of that music. They kind of took it the way, you know, some of the conceptualist painters kind of related to abstract expressionism, which was, they saw it as a vocabulary. And, something that could be formally played with, you know, and was mutable in that way. Well, and I mean, that you could also bring in a lot of elements of, you know, from other art forms, you know, performance art and poetry and music concrete, and, you know, they started experimenting with electronics and, you know, early synthesizers and all that stuff. So they were like a bit, you know, boundless in a way, you know, and they brought in elements from you know, 20th century classical music and, you know, mix that up. And, you know, you get somebody like Anthony Braxton, and he really just, he takes it out on so many levels, like just on the song, the song title level alone, where it was like, you know, the titles of the tunes were either mathematical formulas, you know, that had kind of looping spirals and, you know, these graphic figures, you know, down to like some of the titles, he would actually have like little drawings of, you know, he'd have like a mathematical formula and then maybe a drawing of a guy pumping gas or something. So, you know, these guys had a lot of wit too, you know, and that was one of the things that was a saving, a kind of saving grace from the potential pretentiousness of it all.
Absolutely, but it also points to something that seems like a real thread in your work, which is to kind of highlight or reframe what you might call the modernist impulse in black culture in America, which is so easy to get lost with the vivacity of all of these bodies and icons and, you know, juiciness, that there's a tendency both in, especially in terms of art, and you really wrote some eye-opening essays about, you know, characters I didn't know very much about. I only heard their names, like Thornton Dial and, you know, other characters in the book that you cover, which in a really interesting way. So you're really looking at art per se, but also just generally in terms of culture, that there is this modernist impulse that's formalist. There's irony, there's wit, there's an abstraction, an element of alienation, even an element of science fiction. And in a way, that kind of modernist impulse goes in that direction of some of these visionary science fiction characters like Sun Ra, whatever, that you're interested in. So could you flesh out a little bit more, like, what is that modernist impulse? What is it that often gets lost in the kind of even positive sort of engagement with Black American culture?
Well, the thing you find out when you actually read or get to sit down with any of these people who work in these forms that are basically considered, they're very, you know, everything that pretty much everything that Black people do in America is considered expressive first, you know, to just kind of, you know, leap out of people's nervous systems or leap out of their gyrating, sweating bodies, you know. The thing you find out, though, is that when people do a thing well enough that the whole world starts paying attention, like breakdancing, somebody's kind of spent, you know, the requisite, if we want to use Gladwell's measure, you know, 10,000 hours kind of working out the schematics of the thing and working out the mathematical variables, you know, on like, you know, vectors and angles, you know, they've worked out their own kind of jerry-rigged techniques, you know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, first, I remember, you know, Duke Booty, who wrote half of The Message, you know, for Grandmaster Flash. I remember his description of Flash was a young technocrat, you know. And then you learn, of course, that Flash studied like electrical engineering in high school. And, you know, that's why he was, you know, able to kind of construct, you know, his kind of first his own mixer himself. And he developed all these other techniques and these ways of identifying where the breakbeat was in the record. You know what I mean? So the desire to not just express a thing, you know what I mean, that has some kind of visceral impact, but then to be able to kind of diagrammatically break down and repeat the operation, you know, already on, and that's just, you know, that just puts you on one side of the, you know, the modernist impulse. You know, it's kind of the desire to kind of create new techniques to generate, you know, what folks call the shock of the new, and to repeat the effect. You know what I mean? To not just do it once. Like, you may have discovered it once, you know, by accident, but then, you know, those guys go back and spend hours refining it you know, and that's in jazz, that's in hip hop, that's in blues. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's not an accident. So, but then the other side of it has to do with, you know, there's a whole line of thinking that modernism, of course, is a response to the absurdity of industrialized murder, you know, in 20th century life, that a group of artists in Europe, particularly in Paris, were responding to after the First World War, you know, which was the first kind of high-tech, long-distance remote control, chemical warfare, laden conflict, you know, and it was the absurdity of mass death that they saw there at the hands of this technology that ended up generating futurism and cubism and Dadaism, you know, and the move away from conventional figurative painting into kind of more abstract forms. And you know, that what of course existed in Black America as a generator of a need to generate work that reflected the absurd condition of modern life was, you know, we didn't have to go to the fields of Europe. You know, we had the red summer killing fields of American lynching. You know what I mean? Just the precariousness and the vulnerability, you know, of Black life to just sudden and random annihilation, you know, because you were the wrong color in the wrong part of town at the wrong part of, you know, wrong time of the day. And you may have spoken too quickly or looked at somebody the wrong way or looked like you had the presence of a brain, you know, and the next thing you know, you're hanging from a tree and it all, you know, manner of amputation and evisceration may have happened too. So I think those two things converge. It's like, I think, and I'll just say, I think that Black culture and particularly Black music is relentlessly modernist. It's obsessively modernist. It's why at the advent of every new piece of technological prosthesis for music making, there are great Black inventors there taking advantage of it and wanting to be recognized and represented and expressive using these new tools.
One of the interesting things about all that is that, like, it's kind of like almost a parallel modernism in the sense that it, just the way you're talking about it, where
the
dynamics are specific or historically specific, but they produce, you know, recognizable responses having to do with technicity, having to do with absurdity. But I wanted
I'll just add, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, you in the conversation, you know, you can't erase, like, the huge debt of modernist forms, of course, to African sculpture and statuary, you know, to African art, you know what I mean? And that the kind of it was like formally the kind of break that the Cubists and the Surrealists, you know, and the Dadaists wanted to make had to do with wanting to interject, like, a certain kind of horror and enchantment that, you know, these Western artists saw in kind of the first African sculpture they saw, you know, in the sense that these things were magic objects and wanted to recreate that effect, you know. So you got this, you know, this weird kind of loop that's going on. You have African-Americans separated from Africa in terms of that kind of formal art making, but experiencing a kind of horror that, you know, I'd even go so far as to argue, like, kind of pulled, you know, the desire to have a kind of more plastic relationship to musical expression, artistic expression, kind of you know, out of folks' psyches and bodies and whatnot, you know.
And one element of that that's also interestingly different in this parallel modernity is the way in which even some of those innovators who are grabbing onto new tools and technologies, you can think about Sun Ra, you can think about Hendrix, you can think about also Brahms, you can go on and on, is that
right.
It's often coupled with something else that's really a key element to your interests, and it, which is this, you know, visionary myth science, cosmic,
right,
you know, sort of religious, sort of poetics of outer space and weirdness, basically. And there's a way in which those things get coupled in some of these black modernist figures, not just musicians, but artists as well, that to my mind is different than the way some of that visionary material shows up in white modernism, where it's often much more ironized and much more distanced.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, of course, you know, one of the core questions around what we can call black identity, you know, has to do with at what point did Africans become African Americans? You know, at what point, what generational marker had people been made to let go of the kind of rituals and practices and language and even worship, you know, forms of worship that would distinctly define you as an African, and that you become this other hybridized thing, you know. And in some cases, I mean, it began, you know, you can look at examples like Benjamin Banneker, famous 17th century or 18th century black mathematician and astronomer and architect, who you know, was one of the first African Americans, you know, to not only be involved with stargazing, you know, but also wrote highly critical letters of proof of intelligence to Thomas Jefferson, who had written these essays or, you know, these treatises on the limited, you know, intellectual capacity, you know, of Africans, you know, black people, you know, I guess to justify his own slaveholding. But the thing about Banneker that's interesting is that, you know, his father was an African that was brought, you know, to the States and ended up, I think, marrying, I think his father was actually an indentured servant. So he comes even from a period right before slavery really gets organized as we know it. And I think he married an Irish woman, and they produced Banneker, you know what I mean? But and there's some speculation that the father was a member of the Dogon tribe, you know, and we could return to that mythos later, you know what I mean, that link. But but Banneker kind of is a beginning point for a certain kind of black transcendentalism. The moment at which black Americans begin being converted to Christianity is yet another point. The moment at which they start using the hymnals and spiritual songs, you know, the spirituals, to actually conduct escapes, you know, and the path and as code, you know, to kind of make it, you know, from one point to the next on the Underground Railroad, becomes this other period where the musical expression becomes, you know, wrapped in creating a language of transgression and transformation and escape, you know, fugitivity, you know, speaking in a way that completely goes over the heads of, you know, the so-called master race, you know. So the music takes on this meta, kind of meta poetic, liberatory force, you know, sound itself, you know, and what can be hidden inside of sound, you know, becomes a feature of this music as it's developing. And then it's like you start reading things about like the early black, particularly kind of Pentecostal church, you know, where the kind of experiences that people cite as features of ritual possession in African culture start showing up in this African American culture, you know, people being taken by spirits and speaking in tongues and speaking in voices and languages that they don't formally know. You know, this becomes another way in which the production of sound becomes linked to something beyond, you know, mortal kin, you know, become where in which people become messengers of voices.
Do you see that tradition? Like, how is that translating in our contemporary moment? The impulses is strong, that sense of music, of sound being a gateway to something beyond, something revolutionary and that, something cosmic in that. Is that something that waxes and wanes with the changing times, or does it remain a kind of steady impulse that you can point to today?
Yeah, well, I think that it's such a part of the I think what it does is it migrates, you know, now I think into different forms, you know, and it migrates into forms where people may not have had the same access to a public space, you know, that they once did. So there are people who are working with visual art and performance now, you know, kind of within the gallery scene, you know, the international exhibition scene, you know, who are black, who are actually trying to bring that kind of ritualistic reflection into the work, and, you know, function as kind of meta beings, you know, in those performances as people that can't just be identified as kind of avatars of blackness, but avatars of some other shit, you know, and it's like, I mean, if I wanted to look back, like, let's just say in, you know, and this is really interesting because, you know, I think the last time, like right before 1999, you had all of this kind of very millennial, futurist, apocalyptic work coming through, you know, coming out of the hip hop era and out of the crack era of hip hop, you know, and into the millennium. You know, you had Wu-Tang Clan, you had Public Enemy, you had Busta Rhymes, you know, you had Ram LZ, you know, you had all, you know, and then you had Tricky and you had the drum and bass guys. I mean, you know, but all these people are kind of pushing for this very spiritualized futurism, you know, and trying to create a sound that kind of broke the temporal barrier, as it were. You know, they kind of pushed us, rammed us into, sonically rammed us into the future, you know. Then once we kind of made that transition, you know, and once it actually became the 21st century, I think that there was a certain, almost like a kind of a deflationary collapse of the futurist impulse, and not just in black culture, but I just think even, you know, even in science fiction itself, you know what I mean? Where, okay, we've arrived here and it ain't quite the future we were promised, but then again, it is, you know, in the sense that, it's kind of everything we thought that, or everything that science fiction writers for the last 100 years, had thought would be a feature of the 21st century landscape, we actually kind of got the experience in a holodeck way through the quality of CGI, You know what I mean? So all of those stories, you know, that we had seen done in the hokiest manner possible, and kind of completed the experiential connection to the Fantasia through suspension of disbelief. It's like now, yeah. I mean, once Spielberg did Jurassic Park in particular, you just felt like, wow, those dinosaurs really look like they are really in that room and about to eat those kids, you know. And then you know, even on all the, you know, the shows, Star Treks and everything. I mean, everything just got such a ramp up, you know, to be that these things that we thought that turned out to not be quite technologically feasible were still experientially possible, you know, just through the quality of the simulacrum.
Yeah, the simulacrum is really out of control right now. It's kind of remarkable. You can almost feel there's a sort of weirdness where if you've spent too much time away from it, you can kind of feel like you're missing something, even though you're just like living an ordinary embodied life, and you're like, wait, there's something missing because I'm not like pumping in the virtual icons.
No, I remember one time, my daughter was over at my house, and like, I was kind of maxing out all the media at the same time. I think I was working on something, you know. So I had the computer, I had the phone, I had the TV, you know. And she just said, "Dad, I need media."
Oh man, yeah. We're swimming in it now. I mean, I'm kind of curious on your own, like how you see your own work as kind of keeping some of that in it, like not just that you're writing about it and remembering and reconfiguring and echoing, but that even in your prose and, you know, particularly sometimes your notable continuous references to astrology that go beyond the good taste of a secular New Yorker.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, but I mean, I'm very 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 consistent with an Afrocentric modernist from the 70s. You know, it's like, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, black people in conversation, you know, the last couple of generations, you know, reference people's personality disorders to the zodiac sign quite casually and without, you know, without any shame. You know what I mean? There's no like kind of anxiety of being, you know, of being read as like fluky or insane.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's
because you know we speak about you know, people's zodiac related personas with great authority and confidence. You know what I mean? So
yeah. Know. No, it's fresh, you know. As a if you're on the, you know, from my perspective, it's like it's a, you know, you're asking for trouble unless you do it with just the right amount of, like, you know, where you're gonna get, are you gonna get in some argument with some guy and they're just gonna take you down, you know, and this is gonna be this whole thing about science and rationale, and you're like, man, it's like, you know, but I can't deny, it's in my life, you know, it's just the way I've seen things. I've always seen things astrologically. It's like it's just the language that makes sense to me. So
oh yeah, man. Yeah, no, and I recommend, you know, if you haven't heard it already, like Mary Lou Williams, jazz pianist, did a whole album of compositions dedicated to the signs of the zodiac. And it's like, if you have particular feelings about people who are born under one sun sign or another, like she just really captured, I think, the character of each one, the particularities, the peculiarities of each one in melody and harmony and rhythm, man, you know. It's a great, if nothing else, you can have fun projecting your prejudices onto this music as you listen to it. You're like, yeah, you're gonna find yourself going, yeah, that's those Capricorn motherfuckers right there, in that measure right there. You got it. But I mean, you know, man, it's like, again, I mean, it goes back to your modernist thing. I mean, I think it's, you know, like the play of, between rationalism and absurdity, the irrational inside of that kind of art making and myth making, you know, is actually where the juice is in the thing, You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And this leads me to another question that is, for me, one of the great conundrums, that something that no one's written about it in the way that it should be, and it's a great cultural question for me. And I'll set it up by saying I just saw the Brain Feeder show at the Fox in Oakland. George Clinton put on the best performance I'd ever seen him play, but I didn't see him back in the day. But like it was an excellent situation, and then he was followed by Flying Lotus, and it was and what I was thinking about, I was like, well, especially Flying Lotus, Flying Lotus was very what I would call psychedelic. It was
Hey man, Alice Coltrane, who's more psychedelic than Alice, who wrote about her LSD experience?
Totally. But here's the question. So here's the question: is that even as you can point to these extraordinary figures of music and culture in Black America, Hendrix, Alice Coltrane, whatever, where there, or Clinton himself, where there is some obvious psychedelia, there's also a weird sort of distrust, maybe of hippies, maybe of something that also creates a kind of reaction against psychedelia within the discourse of modern Black culture. Does that make sense to you? Or at least it's hard.
You know what? I mean, it's difficult for me to call it a distrust of the psychedelic experience. You know what I mean? Because I'm a kind of I'm like I'm a kind of a generational anomaly in terms of the drug experience, because like when I was really young, like 14, 15, man, I became like a kind of self-righteous vegan for a period, and so that meant that, I wasn't going to pollute my temple. It's like the point at which all my other friends started experimenting with drugs. I was trying to be this pure vessel, so then that continued on into Howard, my Howard University years. But at Howard, man, like, all my classmates, they tried every drug at least once just so they could experience what the high was. It was like the kind of free experimentation with drugs, like, had a lag in Black culture. You know what I mean? Just like, kind of mass Black culture. You know what I mean? Because, it's like our kind of, what Fred Red Fox called the Bippy, the Bippy phenomena. In Black culture, the Black hippie phenomenon, it kind of came into R&B in a full-on way, like, just as it was kind of waning, in white culture. It was like, with white culture was kind of making this transition in the folk rock and aggro, hyper-masculinist metal, and Black culture was getting real groovy, and you can, you hear it in just the transition in the music from, like, Motown to James Brown, all of a sudden Funkadelic and Earth, Wind & Fire and, Kool and the Gang, and you know what I mean? And then, certainly just in all the trappings, they're just, as it got more kind of super heroic, in attire. It also kind of got more Afrodelic, we could say. Mothership Connection, the whole thing, and then, I mean, but, George and Sun Ra, man, who are certainly, like, the avatars of kind of Black hippiedom, I mean, they spent so much time in Ann Arbor, man. You know what I mean? Even though, I mean, Sun Ra was like as anti-drug as Frank Zappa, but, the cats in his band used to sneak out and hang out with the White Panthers and MC5. And those cats, and both of those bands were kind of in that scene at around the same time, kind of freely mingling, chemistry and bodily fluids, so I think that it's kind of interesting, because it's not until you get to actually 90s hip hop, and the resurgence of Black nationalism, that you get this kind of hard break between, Black and white youth identity again. Because you know, certainly, you know, I mean, look, man, the whole, we know the early hip hop scene, man, you know, and Basquiat and the Graph, you know, the Subway Graph Writers, you know, man, I mean, they're, you know, they were part of our whole 80s village experience, you know what I mean? Or they came down to kind of, you know, to have like a kind of mixed, you know,
absolutely
inter-ethnic, interfaith experience at the Roxy and you know, like the you know, the Peppermint Lounge and Dance Interior, you know, and then when you, you know, and then when you start bringing in the queer element, you know what I mean, like those clubs, you know, like Paradise Garage and, you know, and some of those other places, that's all downtown, you know,
yeah,
kind of New York stuff too. So but yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, and that's a whole interesting kind of question just in terms of the kind of cultural, sexual, chemical exchange, that, particularly in New York, man, because, you know, as we all know, I mean, New York is not really, you know, part of mainland America. You know what I mean? It's like it is completely like an island unto itself, you know, kind of an island of Dr. Moreau itself relative to the rest of America.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. But so I mean, John Michelle, it's like Basquiat, you know, I mean, just another clear example of somebody who had, you know, and, you know, definitely came from Brooklyn, you know, into the East Village to have his own kind of interfaith experience and have a platform to you know, room to breathe and dream and whatnot, you know what I mean? So, I mean, I think if anything, you know, you've got these people who are like the godfathers of kind of an Afrocentric futurism, you know, who kind of find their most receptive audiences initially among like doped up white kids, you know?
Yeah. No, that's what I was thinking at the show too, just looking around me and going like, look at all this crowd and like, what are they taking in? How is that taking in? What's this kind of transfer that's going on here? It was very positive, actually. I was very happy just to see it go down, and it's always been an interesting element. I think what I'm mostly just, I want the story written. I haven't read it. Like,
I would say, you know, and this even goes back to, you know, like when you talk about a parallel modernism, you know, one of the things that's eventually like got to happen in terms of American historiography, cultural historiography, is like at some point somebody's going to just start telling the story of music as the story of all the music, you know what I mean? Like, and not look at, say, like, you know, at the point at which, you know, black music starts, you know, being defined as this alien artifact inside a majority white culture, and so-called classical music goes on to do whatever it's going to do. They're not, you know, it's like once you kind of take the social boundary set up by Jim Crow out of the musicology, you know, there's no way you can tell the story of jazz without, you know, without talking about it as being an adaptation and a continuation of the 12-tone system. You know what I mean? It's not like black people invented another scale or harmony system. They're using the same one. They're just bringing, you know, like all this warpage into the thing, you know, into the actual expression of the notes. But the whole thing is, you know, when you start talking about what the modernists are trying to do in music, you know, the Stravinsky's and Debussy's and the Dvorak's and the Cages, you know, when he was actually still writing music that other people could play without having to, you know, like perform dance steps, and shit, you know, like maybe Cage is like the James Brown of abstract neoclassical music is.
Hey, but, we only got a little bit of time left, and you mentioned James Brown. You got a James Brown book coming out. What's
that's not, no, not anymore, man. You know what I mean? Like, that contract has actually been null and void for a couple of years. I wrote a draft of it, and my editor and I didn't quite see eye to eye. So, I'm still under that contract. It's with FS&G. And what it's become now is I'm going to write a book on black icons. You know, that's the next project I'm working on. It's what the James Brown contract has been transmuted into.
So when you say icons, you mean just like some of the greatest faces, names, Miles Davis.
And mostly 20th century people. But I decided I was going to use, Miles and Ali and James Brown as templates of the other about 15 people that, you know, I feel like the page count can hold. If I'm going to write about them with any seriousness. I want to look at people who are, the working title for the book is Beast Mode, Gods and Monsters of the Black Atlantic, you know. And so I'm looking at people who had this kind of roaring, thunderous, seismic impact in their field, but also there was these reverberations into the political, cultural, social, economic sphere beyond them. So, you know, I mean, Michael Jordan, you know, is going to be in there. The Williams sisters, you know, Winnie and Nelson Mandela, some more obscure people like Octavia Butler, Samuel Delaney, you know, not obscure to us, of course, but to people who, you know, I don't know how many people who know who Michael Jordan is that also know, Octavia Butler and,
Fair enough.
Yeah, Delaney. So, and I'm still trying to figure out, you know, like who the 18 to 20 people are. But that's the next kind of long form writing project. You know, you may see some self published speculative fiction by me before then, because I've got a ton of stories. In that vein, some have been published in small press.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. But one of the problems with, continually being under these nonfiction contracts is that you can't get a contract to do any other kind of writing or get anything else looked at. You know, so I just said, man, just bump it. I'm just going to go ahead and put this stuff out. You know, because it's a ton of stuff from really like about the last 25 years.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see that. I mean, like we, as I said, I just got a couple minutes, and it's, you know, we are living in science fiction, not the one we necessarily expected.
I like the way a friend of mine's progressive radical hip hop artist Mike Ladd, but he did an album kind of around, I think it was around like 1999 or 2001, somewhere in there. I can't remember early, you know. Anyway, it's called like Welcome to the After Future, you know. And I feel, you know, I've just always felt like he really kind of nailed it in terms of where we are in that that sense of diminishing returns around the whole, you know, futurology as it relates to where the world is, where we are now. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of curious to see whether it's gonna, and I kind of suspect it's gonna take. We'll see more and more weird kind of religious or mystical forms, because that allows you to you know, build a future or a science fiction or a, you know, a portal or an interdimensional point like within your experience or within your consciousness. And as the physical world and the sense of real world politics become so claustrophobic and so full of despair and difficulty, right. that you're going to just see like some really crazy, crazy, cray cray stuff is going to be on the horizon, because that futurist impulse has to go somewhere. And, you know,
where it is, man, in a way, it's like, it's in the room with the folks running the Hadron Super Collider, man. They're the ones.
Absolutely.
You Like, I mean, they're looking for God particles. They're looking to prove these, you know, like figure out what dark matter and dark. I mean, you've got all these mysteries that if human beings actually like kind of crack that code the way they cracked electromagnetism and nuclear fission, you know, like just open up the world to a whole possibility of horrors, you know, and horrible speculation, you know. But I mean, you know, I mean, definitely, you know, it's kind of no question. Like the prophets of now, were definitely like Ballard and Dick, man.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah. Like they got just like the meanness and the venality of the future we're living in now. You know what I mean? You know, some of which just has to do with like, I think that. On a zeitgeist, like mass consciousness level, the realization that we really are stuck on this planet. You know, like our technology is just so busted in terms of being able to do any of the things that science fiction thought, you know, we'd be. I mean, you know, well, you know, it's funny because Star Trek, in terms of like the time at which certain technology came online, like, you know, they may have just gotten it completely right. You know, to be like we're 100 years off, you know, from the kind of discoveries that allow, you know, artificial gravity and, you know, something close to light speed, yeah. You know, well, all these kind of things, you know, radiation, all of that shit, man.
We're going to have to leave it there. So, Greg, thanks so much, man, for being on the show, man.
Yeah, man. Great, man. Thanks for reaching out and yapping with a brother.
All right. Okay. And for y'all out there, keep your minds open.